Thank you. Second case of the morning, the United States versus Fleshly. Gardner?
Good morning, Your Honor. Your Honor, as you know from reading the brief, there are 10 or 12 issues in this case. I'm not obviously going to be able to address all of them, but I'm going to start from the beginning and see how far I can get.
Well, why don't you tell us what are the three best ones here?
Your Honor, I think the primary issue would be the question of the search warrant, because obviously that would have the broadest possible effect on the outcome of the case, so that's what I was intending to address first. I think the next significant issue would be the question of the exemption from Section 922-0 and Section 5822, and the next issue would be the question of whether the government had the obligation to prove that the possession substantially affected interstate commerce. So I was going to address them in that order.
You don't think that the sentencing issue is one of your three?
Well, Your Honor, I think they're all significant issues. It's a little hard to categorize them like that, but it is that is also a significant issue.
Will you fire away and do what you can?
Thank you, Your Honor. With regard to the search warrant, Your Honor, it's our position that the search warrants here are invalid because the affidavit did not provide the magistrate judge probable cause believe that evidence of a crime would be found in either location. And the primary argument on that is that the main informant that the government, that the affidavit relied on, Mr. Dapron, there are no facts in the affidavit which allowed evaluation of his asserted knowledge. Now, the government says that the fact that his information is detailed is basically sufficient to support what he says, and they also say that there is corroboration from statements the defendant made to a police officer. With respect to the information being detailed, that's certainly the case, but I don't think under the case law that really is sufficient. There's got to be something more because he could be a very elaborate liar. And there's got to be something more than that shows that his information has been, and corroboration is probably the most important thing under the Supreme Court case law.
But wasn't much of the highly detailed information that was provided by Mr. Dapron verified by the police before the warrant was issued?
No. The only thing the police verified was the physical location. They drove by the office, the business location, and verified that it was there, and they drove by the residence and verified it was there. And under there's a case that I cited from the Eighth Circuit and another from the Fourth Circuit that indicate that merely checking innocent information, corroborating innocent information, is not adequate. There's nothing that shows that Dapron himself, there's nothing that they corroborated of Dapron's of his incriminating information, which they were able to corroborate.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Judge Rosa. Sorry.
Thank you. Didn't other sources place the guns in the house 2 weeks before the warrant issued?
There was another source which indicated that sometime in the prior 3 months, one of the guns had been in the house. But that source was a confidential informant who told somebody else, who told somebody else, who told somebody else. And that, I don't think, comes anywhere near close to meeting the requirements for an anonymous tip, which is what it was. That confidential informant is never identified. The other source of information which they relied on was a person named Mr. Gibbs, but he expressly said, and it's in the affidavit, that he had not seen the firearm. So certainly they can't be relying on his information since he said he didn't even see it. And so there is no independent corroboration. The only thing that there is that would come remotely close to independently corroborating what Dapron was saying was a statement that Mr. Fleishley made to a police officer where he said that he had recently brought several guns down to a machine gun shoot in Kentucky. That was it. He didn't say, as the government says in its brief, and you can just read the affidavit, he did not say that he had several guns. It's simply not in there. What he said was that he had brought several guns to Kentucky. He did not say that he had any guns at his home or at his business. What he said, in fact, was that the licensee in this case was located, in fact, in Petersburg, Illinois. There's no reference to him saying that the guns were at his home or at his business, and the affidavit is very clear about that. That is absent in the affidavit. So the only corroboration that, when you boil it all down, that exists here is his statement, Mr. Fleischley's statement, that he had brought several guns to Kentucky. That certainly, I don't think, rises to the level of providing a likelihood or probability that there are going to be firearms found in his home or his business, particularly in light of the fact that he then goes on to indicate, in fact, twice in the affidavit, that the licensee in this case for whom he was working was actually located in Petersburg, Illinois. I also wanted to address the question.
I was interested in this. Your point about the corroboration has to be of illegal activity. What's the basis for that?
Well, the two cases, the Gibson case from the Eighth Circuit and the Wilhelm case from the Fourth Circuit, and also to a large extent the Singleton case from this court, where the police officers in that case actually corroborated the unlawful activity by observing it themselves.
Suppose that the police had information from an informant that someone every Tuesday at noon takes cocaine in a black bag and carries it from point A to point B.
And they were able to verify that he was moving from point A to point B every Tuesday?
Yeah, and they check, and sure enough, this guy every Tuesday carries a black bag from point A to point B. That's not illegal activity. But would you say that that would not be sufficient to support the issue of the warrant?
I would say it's
corroboration of legal activity?
Well, I would say that if the police themselves were to have observed that activity, that might be sufficient. But in this case, and what was in the Wilhelm and Gibson cases, was simply that the only thing they corroborated that the building was there. It's about as innocent as activity as you can get. It's not even activity.
Physical.
It's just existence of a building.
Yeah.
And that's what the Fourth Circuit referred to as merely, or the Ninth Circuit actually in another case referred to as merely static information. And that's all that was corroborated here. And I don't think, even if the hypothetical that you gave was enough, that doesn't exist in this case. Therefore, I don't think that the probable cause was established aside from Daffron. Now, of course, if the court accepts that Daffron's information was reliable, it's a different story. But I think clearly there's nothing that corroborates his testimony. In fact, we requested a Franks hearing because we provided information which the government did not dispute that, in fact, Mr. Daffron was interviewed while he was in jail. And he gave this information while he was in jail after having been convicted of crimes of dishonesty, of moral turpitude, essentially. And yet that's not mentioned anywhere in the affidavit. I know that the government doesn't contest in its brief at this point that we should not have had a Franks hearing. And I don't know whether they just forgot about it or what, but in any event, it's undisputed that when Mr. Daffron was interviewed, he was in custody, and we think that is enough to have gotten at the Franks hearing, because the special agent should have had obvious reasons to doubt the veracity of Daffron's allegations. And in fact, we put in the record significant evidence that Daffron had a long criminal history. He was not a good citizen coming off the street and relating his observations. And I note that in the Singleton case, it talks about some of the matters that one would look to, that a court would look to determine veracity. And I think it implies that there are other things that the court can look to. And I think one of those things that the court can look to and should look to is the person's criminal history. And in that case, this should have made a big difference. The other thing that a court should be able to look to is the question of whether this person has ever provided reliable information before. Just to give some examples of what other things are appropriate. We also argued that the information in the affidavit was stale because it went back. I think the last information about Mr. Fleishley having the minigun was that it was there on July 30th. That was based on statements that his father-in-law made. But in fact, if you read the entire affidavit, what it goes on to say is that they also were told that on the date that the warrant was to be executed, August 11th, the guns were not going to be in flight either in Petersburg, where the business was located, or at Mr. Fleishley's place. In fact, they were all going to be taken up to a sheriff's range for a demonstration. So even if you accept the father-in-law's statement is accurate that on July 30th, one of the guns was in Mr. Fleishley's safe at his business. Clearly, on the day that the warrant was going to be executed, the officers knew that it was not going to be there because they had arranged for a demonstration of it at another location.
Let me take you somewhere else, please. Where in the record would we find factual support for the claim that he was working as an agent of SAS at the time of the incident? In other words, did he present some pay stubs or what's the evidence that he was actually employed by SAS?
The testimony, if I remember, of Mr. Tobias and of Mr. Medlock, that he was working, and primarily the testimony of Mr. Tobias, that he was working part of the corporation, manufacturing the firearms for the corporation. And in fact, the government introduced the registration forms for the four machine guns, which indicated clearly that they were registered by the corporation. And so their evidence is in the record that they were manufactured for the corporation because that's who registered them. And I don't think there's any dispute about that Mr. Fleishley was working for the corporation when he was doing what he was doing based on the fact of the registration. But the government's argument at this point is that it doesn't matter that because he was a convicted felon that those statutes nonetheless apply, the two relatives, Section 922-0 and Section 5822. And it's our position that those statutes that his felon status is irrelevant to those particular statutes. Now, we don't argue that he's got a defense to the felon in possession statute because he was working for a corporation. Clearly, he doesn't have that defense. But to a statute where felon status is irrelevant, as in 922-0 and 5822, it is irrelevant, and the fact that he was a convicted felon shouldn't make any difference under those two statutes. And I see I've got my...
Was there any question or evidence or discussion about whether SAS Inc., is that the corporation?
Yes.
Was a fictitious corporation or a front for him?
No. The only evidence that was put in was the government's evidence that it was created by the three individuals, Mr. and Mrs. Tobias and Mr. Medlock. It was duly registered with the state. There was no evidence that it was not that he had anything to do with creating the corporation. He didn't file any of the papers.
So that's not an issue then?
I don't believe that is an issue. The government's position, as I said, is a little bit different, that his felon status by itself is enough to defeat those arguments. And I'll reserve whatever time I have left.
Fine. Thomas?
May it please the court, I'm Patricia Tumo. I represent the government appellee in this case, and I was also one of the trial counsels at the time of trial. In addressing the search warrant and the reliability of Dupron, reliability of Dupron is really not even an issue in this case. The entire search warrant affidavit, which consists of a number of pages and 20-some paragraphs, was all basically corroborated by the police officers, mainly through their own operations. I mean, before they even went to DePron, they had already met with Mr. Gibbs, a friend of the defendant, who had provided that law enforcement officer a business card of the defendant, in which he said, which the business card held out the defendant as president of a manufacturing business, firearms manufacturing business, as well as a form which that he was requesting the law enforcement official to use in order to help him get another machine gun. So the whole purpose of this contact was to enable the defendant to even acquire another machine gun. They already knew that. When they did the checks on that, they already had uncovered that the defendant was not listed, at least legally, as the owner or licensee of that particular business. They also knew at that point in time from their own experience with him, which is spelled out in the affidavit, that he already had felony convictions, had already been investigated for the possession and manufacture of a minigun some years earlier. So they had lots of information. The prong basically corroborated what they already were on to at that point. And the biggest corroboration came from the defendant himself through at least three different phone calls with a police officer in which he admitted he had machine guns, admitted that he had made the minigun, and wanted to purchase this other machine gun. So the whole thing was it was an operation which the defendant was trying to acquire another machine gun and confirmed all of the information that DePron gave the law enforcement agents when they went to talk with him, as well as what they had already found out from the initial onset of the investigation. So to come here and tell you that there was no independent corroboration, or that the only thing that the police did was drive by a business and by a resident, is just ludicrous. Just totally ludicrous. Gates recognizes that you look at totality of the circumstances. That affidavit clearly gave this magistrate judge probable cause to issue the warrant. As far as the staleness, as far as the issue of the Franks hearing, that was never requested. It was dropped as a footnote in the defendant's motion to suppress. The government responded to that footnote in its response, in which they said he hasn't met the Franks test. He hasn't shown that there was an intentional lie by the affiant, which was a police officer at this time, or that there was any reason to believe or any fact sufficient to support the fact that that was that he should have known it was a lie and tried to mislead or whatever the magistrate judge in issuing that. He didn't argue that in his brief. Again, he dropped it as a footnote. So frankly, the issue of Frank's hearing is really not before this court. He has never made that showing, and he could have, because the government responded to it at the motion process. He could have come back. He could have filed a motion for a Frank's hearing and actually met the test of Frank's, but he didn't do that. That's really not an issue for this court. As far as the staleness issue, the entire whole purpose of the operation was to get another machine gun. The totality of the circumstances surely would indicate that this defendant had machine guns at his business, firearms at his home, and which they're not the sort of property that you just easily get rid of. It's not like contraband or drugs where you can flush them down a toilet or whatever. They're things that you keep. So they're things that you expect to find even weeks, months, even years later at a location where they were last seen. The court inquired about whether or not there was whether there was a dispute or is an issue if he was an agent or an employee of this corporation. There definitely is a dispute as to that. It is not the government's position, nor was it at trial, nor is it here, that he was an employee or agent of this corporation. He was the corporation. And he couldn't be the corporation because he has a legal disability. That was the felony conviction. This corporation was not formed by the individuals that appeared on the name of the articles of incorporation or the licensee. As the defendant himself told Agent Fritchie, he orchestrated the license because he knew he could not have it himself. He cannot manufacture firearms. He can't be a licensee, either as a dealer or as a manufacturer, because he has a legal disability.
Did the district court make any findings about whether there was a criminal organization?
With regard to the sentencing issue?
Yeah.
The district court specifically in it, which you'll find at record 67, I believe, his order, indicated that, all right, it is not a role in the, this is not appropriate to give him the two levels as a role in the offense.
Right.
However, I'm going to go down to the application note, and I'm going to give him the two levels as a organizer or as a leader under that theory, let me back up and say that under the role in the offense, basically if you're an organizer or a leader, it indicates that those that you lead or organize have some knowledge of the criminal activity. All right, that's something. Whereas if you follow the application note, there doesn't have to be knowledge on their part that the design of this is for criminal activity.
Well, are you separating the guideline from its application notes and treating the notes as a, you know, its freestanding positions of some sort?
They give the judge the alternative of saying, look, the purpose of the role in the offense adjustment is that we want to penalize a defendant who is going to lead somebody else into criminal activity, whether they know it, specifically if they know it, under the role in the offense.
Well, no, right. Here's my problem. 3B1 applies to managers of other participants or managers of a criminal organization, right? If there were no other participants and the court didn't make a finding about a criminal organization, then how do we enhance two levels?
Okay, the court did not find that Mr. Tobias or Mr. Medlock were participants under that definition.
Right.
But he found they were involved in the organization. He found there was more individuals involved in this criminal activity. I think he called it a criminal activity.
Mm-hmm.
That Mr. Tobias, Mr. Medlock, did not have to specifically know, as you would under a role in the offense, that the intent was for criminal activity, but that they definitely helped him and assisted to achieve that purpose. Therefore, there was more than one involved, and that's a common understanding of what is an organization. Organization is more than one person involved. So the district judge did say there's more than one involved here, and they assisted him in order to accomplish his illegal purpose, and therefore that constitutes the organization.
And that's at record 67.
Record 67, his order, his sentencing order. But looking at the, if you step back and look at the purpose for that guideline, it is to punish a defendant who does lead someone down the path of some sort of criminal activity. The defendant in this case, Mr. Fleischley, he orchestrated the whole thing and used Mr. Tobias and Mr. Medlock in order to accomplish what he needed. If you follow strictly the guidelines, he would not be punished for that. Yet, all of the activity is there for which he should be punished. It should be noted.
Were the others punished in any way?
Pardon?
Were the others convicted of anything?
No, they were not convicted of anything. They were not charged.
Is that necessary?
No, that is not necessary. Under the application note does not require that they be charged or convicted. I don't even think under the role in the offense, even though one of the elements is that they have some knowledge of the criminal activity, that they have to be charged or convicted in order to apply it. And the evidence was clear from the totality of the trial that this whole corporation was nothing but a sham that was created by the defendant in order to enable him to do what he could not legally do. The whole purpose of this was to manufacture and be in the business of firearms. And the defendant wants to assert that, under a commerce clause, that it doesn't apply to him as in possession of machine gun or firearms. But guns are, they're good. They travel across interstate, they travel in interstate commerce. And Congress has the power to regulate interstate commerce. Guns are good, just like drugs, child pornography, whatever you want to look at. And that being the case, they have the right to regulate that. And there's no basis to say that they don't.
Is there any finding, or was it necessary to make any finding that the SAS Inc. was either a sham or fictitious?
No, there wasn't. There really isn't any necessity of doing that. And the reason is that none of the business activity ever even occurred at the Petersburg, at the licensee address. It all occurred by the defendant at his business in Springfield, Illinois. You know, he had the control. He always negotiated any of the demonstrations, any of the weapons, any of the decision-making. He was in control. He had the firearms. He even explained how he had made them, you know, when they were set to go anywhere. He was the one that helped transport them, take them there. He ran it. I mean, Mr. Tobias did not even have the knowledge to manufacture. I think the most he could have done, as he claimed himself, is hand Mr. Fleischley parts.
How did SAS get any kind of a permit?
It was a corporation incorporated by Mr. Tobias, his now deceased wife, and Mr. Medlock. That corporation then went and filed an application for a manufacturer's license without ever acknowledging that Mr. Fleischley would be involved. None of them had any legal disabilities. No.
That's all it takes to manufacture machine guns?
After a review from ATF inspectors to determine what the nature of the business is going to be, it's a little alarming, isn't it? But yes, after they do, they go in and do an inspection or investigation. If they find that they qualify, they find that they have no legal disability and that the business seems to make sense to them, then they can issue the license to manufacture. A Class II manufacturer's license is what it's called. In this case, Mr. Medlock, I mean, they had an advantage because Mr. Medlock already had a Class II or Class III dealer's license, so he had already gone under, I guess you might, review from ATF in prior years, and therefore probably led some sort of credence, credibility to their licensing application. But the inspectors, I don't think, ever really inquire as to the ability of those that are getting the license to be able to do what they want to do. In other words, carry out the business that they're going to carry out. I think they leave that for the review process. In other words, going in and doing auditing and that sort of thing later on to make sure that they're doing what the license actually gives them permission to do.
They do that at some point, huh?
Yeah, the ATF, that's not a part of the record, of course, and
I don't want to divert. Seems weird.
Yeah, but if there are no other questions, the government will yield the remaining time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Gardner, you got 1 minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, first, with regard to the defendant being in charge of the corporation, the undisputed evidence of the defendant was, from Mr. Tobias, was that the firearms were kept at the business in Petersburg, that the records were kept at the business in Petersburg, and that on occasion, of course, the firearms were taken out for demonstration purposes. But on this specific occasion, the August 11th demonstration, of course, Mr. Tobias and Mr. Medlock, both officers of the corporation, participated and accompanied Mr. Fleischley to that demonstration. The fact that a corporation hires an employee with expertise like Mr. Fleischley doesn't indicate that the corporation is a sham. The government's own evidence indicated that the corporation was lawfully created by the three individuals, and they offered no evidence other than the fact that Mr. Fleischley was an employee and acted for the corporation, that the corporation was Mr. Fleischley's corporation.
Thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case will be taken under advisement.